Hello and welcome to another episode of Teaching for Our Time, and we're going to do a couple of episodes on the issue of resuscitation. My name's Claire Bates, I'm one of the consultants with the palliative care team, and I'm with Dr. Ting Tar, who's our registrar. And Ting came up with the title for this, which is Do You Want to Live? Ting, can you explain why you chose that title?
Yeah, that's because sometimes when we broach resuscitation conversations, we end up having them almost as a consenting conversation. And when patients hear, do you want CPR or cardiopulmonary resuscitation, sometimes that can really be translated in their minds as, do I still want to live, or am I ready to die? And that's really not what we're asking here. So we thought that was a good trigger for starting the conversation. But this episode, we're going to concentrate on the truths behind resuscitation and the decision-making process. And then the next one, we'll talk about how to broach discussing it with patients and family. So to start off, in simple terms, Claire, what would you say is the legal framework behind the decision-making here?
Yeah, so back to basics, really. In English law, no patient or family can demand a treatment from a doctor. So the way that it works generally is that the doctor or the medical team decide what is the correct treatment to offer the patient, and then the patient can consent to that treatment. So what they can't do is demand something that isn't on the menu of appropriate treatments. And so when it comes to resuscitation, it's exactly the same, that this is a medical intervention that the medical team must decide, is this an appropriate intervention for this person? And if it is, then it will be offered. But if it's not, then the medical team should be explaining to the person why it's not being offered. And patients and families actually can't demand it if it's not medically appropriate. And I actually think that's not commonly understood by patients and families. So there can be a need to actually clearly and gently explain that this is actually the legal situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you talked about the team making aspect of decision making, and I think that's so important. It's not a burden that should be borne on one clinician, and getting multiple perspectives, be that from your immediate team, the intensive care team, oncology teams if they're involved, can be really helpful to come to a consensus decision.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially if it's not clear, I mean, some of the cases are very obvious what the right thing is to do, but I think if there's any question at all, then there should be consultation.
Absolutely. And then in 2014 we had the landmark Tracy case, which changed the way that people think about resuscitation conversations, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, Claire?
Yeah, so there's a bit of confusion around what happened in 2014. I mean, prior to that, it was enough if someone understood the overall goals and aims of their treatment, that you didn't need to spell out in detail that you weren't going to attempt resuscitation if their heart stopped or they stopped breathing. And what happened with Janet Tracy was that she had what the judges in the end described as terminal lung cancer. And so the treatment for her would have been supportive and palliative care, but she had a road accident, ended up in Addenbrookes Hospital, and the medical team made a decision that she wouldn't be for attempted resuscitation in the event of a cardiac or respiratory arrest. And when her family found out about that, and Janet found out, they were very sort of upset that there'd been no consultation or discussion with them about it. And it ended up going to the Court of Appeal, and their judgment in the summer of 2014 was that it was wrong that the doctors hadn't discussed that decision with Janet and her family. And so they made a ruling that from that point on, that any DNA CPR decision needed to be discussed with the person who it concerned, which is obviously the patient. So they weren't saying actually that the medical team were wrong to put the DNA CPR order on Janet. It was the right decision for someone in her medical situation, but what was wrong was that they didn't inform a patient who had capacity that that huge decision really had been made.
And there was a caveat that if their conversations would trigger extreme sort of psychological distress, or if the patient was very clear that they did not want to be a part of such discussions, then that was permissible. However, it's highlighted that, you know, their unusual circumstances and our first sort of attempt should always be to try to include and involve them as much as possible.
So I think since that ruling happened, definitely now it should be the case that we always discuss. And I think in the time that I've been practicing since then, we haven't had to call on the extreme psychological distress caveat. So it did quite dramatically change the way that we practice. But at the same time, because it's the law, that is also a way into the conversation, is that, you know, legally I'm obliged to tell you. And then you explain what you need to say. I guess we'll come on to that in the second episode.
And then I guess another important sort of thing to address in terms of facts is how successful is CPR, and actually what does success really mean when we talk about restarting someone's heart?
Yeah, so obviously there's a range of evidence out there about the success of this as a medical intervention, and it depends a lot on the person that you're doing the intervention to. So you and I have been looking up some of the stats, and we came up with quite a broad range. So in the extreme case, an in-hospital cardiac arrest, if everything goes according to plan and you've just got quite a straightforward kind of single organ issue, so a big heart attack or valvular failure or something like that, and you have immediate on-site resuscitation, then the success rate may be as high as sort of 40-50%. That's not necessarily saying recovery to pre-morbid state, but it's that you live.
Yeah.
Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, patients who have metastatic cancer and have shown a progressive decline throughout their hospital admission, if CPR is attempted in those patients, then one study we found, albeit from a few years ago, but it showed that the success rate was 0%. So obviously it depends on the person that you're looking to try and resuscitate. And the problem is that most people have got their idea of what success rate would be from television dramas. And so there's also been some interesting research that shows that members of the public will always overestimate their chance of a successful cardiac resuscitation.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said, success sort of like being the heart being restarted and being alive, and then actually the comorbidities that you may or may not be left with afterwards are sort of a whole other thing to think about, and that requires some careful discussion with patients and family in terms of what's important to them in terms of quality of life and what risks they find acceptable or not.
Yeah.
And I think it's also important to remember that resuscitation discussions should be in a wider context of treatment escalation plans and advanced care plans, and to frame it in a way for people where it's not just about something that we're not giving, but all the things that we will continue to do for them. So be that intravenous fluids or antibiotics, non-invasive ventilation, there's still lots of other things.
Yeah, and I think that relates to your title of the episode, doesn't it? That actually we're not saying, when we say to someone that we're not going to attempt resuscitation, we're not saying that we're not going to carry on medical treatment. What we're saying is we're recognising the limits of what medical treatment can offer, but that we are going to do all these other things that you need and that are appropriate to do for you.
Absolutely. And the final thing, I guess, is how to make sure resuscitation decisions are communicated not just with patients and family, but with the wider healthcare team. And then that links into our episode on advanced care planning and coordinate my care, which was kindly done by Lucy Payne. So please do listen to that as well.
Yeah, that's a seamless plug for that. I mean, like, coordinate my care is so important because it is a digital platform for recording. This is this is a new thing that we can do now that, you know, 10 years ago we couldn't do. It was just a paper form, and also a paper form that would be rewritten in different settings, whereas now it's one time decision, a conversation that is then recorded for everyone who needs to know that see.
Absolutely, and that's so important for patients and family, because I've come across people where the information isn't shared and they're just like oh, every time do I have to have this conversation? So yeah, we can't plug that enough.
Yeah, and it is a difficult conversation to have. I mean, it's difficult for staff to do it, and it's difficult for patients and families to receive it sometimes. So that would be our plug to listen to the next episode, where we're going to try and give you some tips about talking about resuscitation with people. Good. Well, I think that's probably enough.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks a lot.